Hi everyone, welcome back to Bookish. My guest this week is my old boss, Damon Lindelof. You will all know Damon Lindelof as the showrunner and co-creator of the tiny series called Lost, in which I was lucky enough to play a little part. He also showran and co-created The Leftovers for HBO. He wrote the Star Trek movies, a couple of them, Cowboys and Aliens, Prometheus, you know, small stuff. Damon was lovely enough to step away from the writer's room of The Watchmen, which is the graphic novel that he is adapting for HBO, and give me an hour of his very valuable time and talk to me about his five most formative books. It was really fun. It was so nice to see him again and catch up, and he was so generous with himself and his time and his stories. So I hope you enjoy the interview. It is so lovely to have you on the show. Thank you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. It's agreeing. So nice seeing you again.
It's so oh my nice God. Seeing
it's been,
you.
It's been too long.
I know it has been. So I came up with this. Well, you've listened to the podcast because it now exists.
Yes.
So, you know, I just came up with this because I love
so cool
reading. And I love, as I found after season one, it's just such a fun way to get to talk to somebody. It really is. The excuse, the way I get in the room is to ask you for your books, but it's really just an excuse to sit and talk to you.
No, and it is like a biography of someone, right? Where it's sort of like, ooh, like, you know, Julie Bowen, like, is totally into Judy Blume.
Totally.
Like, who knew?
Who knew,
like,
right?
Like, but weren't we all?
It's so funny, though, because I feel like I'm totally exposed now that season one is out and in the world, because everyone let me come into their lives being like, yeah, sure, I'll talk about books, and then left slightly dazzled an hour later going, wait, I just told you about my entire childhood. So the gig is up. But thank you for doing this.
I'm happy to talk about John Hamm's childhood.
Good.
We all want to know.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Tell me about what you're reading now. Are you reading anything good at the moment?
Oh my God. I am at this moment in time, I'm reading We Were 8 Years in Power, the Ta-Nehisi Coates, which is, it's all essays that he published in The Atlantic over the course of the Obama presidency. The essays aren't new, but for every essay, he writes sort of like a new introduction, and then there's a new essay at the end of it that sort of is like, and here's Trump. So,
have you got to the last one? I went to hear him speak just in LA.
Yeah, I was there too.
Were you there?
At the Wilshire Able.
With all the other white
exactly. people nodding our heads and feeling proud of ourselves for how woke
we
are.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but it's become somewhat of, I think, to his understandable chagrin, like a status symbol for woke white intelligentsia to carry around between the world and me. But it's like his writing is incredible and provocative and upsetting and there's nothing like it. So
I agree.
And I'm actually, I guess people say reading now for anything that is in book form, but I'm actually listening to that book on my commute. So
oh,
I downloaded it on Audible.
Does he narrate it?
He doesn't narrate that one. No. I don't even know who the guy is.
Oh,
he's
interesting.
Good, but if you get the wrong reader, you're completely and totally
hosed. It ruins it, doesn't it? Yeah, I agree, totally. That's why Audible is such a gamble. I prefer it, ideally, if it is the person that wrote it. I feel like you get a level of intention, even if they're not the world's greatest readers. He was great at that talk. Although I'd mind it, I mind the co-opting. I mind the feeling like, oh, we don't get to have you because we're white. I feel like that is only presumably to some degree prolonging the entire problem that we're talking about. It feels like, no, you're just going to have to surrender to the fact that you're an extremely popular writer.
Right.
with all races or both black and white. And I don't know that you get to corral yourself off from the rest of us.
Yeah, I think it's more, who knows, but it's the struggle with fame. You know, he keeps like his reprieve in the multiple podcasts where I've heard him interviewed is sort of like, hey, I'm just a writer.
Right.
You know, I'm not an activist.
Right,
I don't want to be the voice of a generation.
Sure.
I'm just sort of, because I think that he didn't get in this to become famous.
I get that, yeah.
And I think that's got to just, it's got to be kind of alarming. You know, you sort of understand that. Whereas like someone who wants to be an actor or like now if you're a television showrunner, you're sort of signing up for like, yeah, I've got to do press. I've got to like kind of do the song and dance. Mm-hmm. Like I'm a public personality. Mm-hmm. I think that there's probably still a part of most authors that wants to go on book tour and show up at sort of like an obscure like little nook in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and read for 25 people, mm-hmm. and then suddenly there he is in front of 1,000 people, yeah. and
thousand white faces,
I understand. It's less like this book isn't for you, but it's sort of more if your angle is white supremacy isn't going anywhere. That this is an incredibly fucked up country that we live in. And now you're basically a fan of mine. I think like that whole like idea just feels a little bit icky. Yeah. But that's kind of what makes it so interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And no, it does. It makes him complicated in a way that makes him even as interesting as his writing is, I think.
Sure. Yeah. But the idea that I think like a decade ago, certainly from the white perspective, there wasn't like who's the voice of what the current status of race in America is. Who is that person? Mm-hmm. You wouldn't be able to answer that question. And now it's sort of like, oh, it's Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yeah, he's
and
the
so
yeah.
like that's got to there's got to be a lot of weight on his shoulders as a result of that too.
Yeah, I agree. I heard him. The Atlantic have just started a podcast which I love, and they were interviewing the author of Americana, Chimamanda.
Oh yeah, my wife read that book. She loves
it's wonderful.
Yeah,
it's really good. It came up on the podcast. And Ta-Nehisi Coates happens to be in the room. I guess he's a friend, and he's hanging out in the hotel room in Paris, uh-huh. and he's totally chipping into her interview. And they have kind of a love-hate, because I guess they're both the voices, black voices of their generation to a degree. Although she's ferociously Nigerian and is vociferous about the fact that Ta-Nehisi's never set foot in Africa, which is interesting. Anyway, total sidebar. But it's a really good podcast and kind of fun to listen to.
Excellent.
Let's talk about your first book. Which one would you like to talk about first? The one you first gave me was The Stand by Stephen King, but you talk about whichever makes sense to you chronologically.
Yeah, I'll you know, I mean, I'm into nonlinear storytelling, so they don't necessarily need to be in the order or the sequencing in which I read them. And I think I was probably 12 or 13 when I read The Stand, if memory serves.
Who gave it to you?
My dad. Mm. My dad was a voracious reader. He would read like a book every couple days.
Really?
And he was a big genre guy. Mm-hmm. Also into the classics, but he loved science fiction and fantasy. And
do you know why?
He read a lot of nonfiction as well. I don't know. I mean, a lot of it is just like whatever floats your boat, what mm-hmm. your tastes are. But I think that he was born in Indiana and was raised by, his parents were very religious, and their entire culture was sort of like built around the community of their church. And my dad was kind of like born agnostic / atheist. Mm-hmm. And also he had a brother who was 13 years older than he was. And so his brother basically became like kind of a surrogate parent for him in many ways, and he was unplanned, my dad, mm-hmm. and his parents were older by the time he came along, so his brother was into like a lot of comic books and superhero fiction and sci-fi and horror stuff,
right?
And that's how he kind of
so
got
inherited
into
it.
But it's also like that's what he liked,
uh-huh.
you know. I mean, that's how he was raised, mm-hmm. and so he always carried a book around with him, and when I was in Little League or basketball as like a 7 or 8 year old kid, my dad would come to the game, but he would read a book. And so and it was sort of like, you know, thanks for coming, but fuck you, you know. But then
I relate so badly. But then, I know that's going to be me.
But then it was also sort of like, you know, this is the territory on which we will meet. My dad was never interested in sports. He you know, it was like he didn't play them. He didn't even know how many innings were in a baseball game, and mm-hmm. or what the rules of football were. Like that was the area where he could completely and totally engage. So I think that part of my early interest in, you know, in was reading the books that he was reading.
Sure.
And my mom, she's retired now, but she was a reading teacher. So,
oh, wow.
You know, like, but she read to me, you know, when I was in utero. So mm-hmm. I think that there was just like a real love of books. And she was much more and remains much more into sort of like mystery novels and crime fiction, mm-hmm. and of course, you know, the classic literature that you get taught in elementary school, because she was an elementary school teacher. But she was sort of less of a genre fan. I don't mm-hmm. think she like hated it, but mm-hmm. she gets scared in horror movies, and my dad kind of got turned on by that stuff.
Do you think being we mentioned this before we started recording, but do you think being an only child encouraged a love of literature? Do you think were books a replacement? They were for me. I'll stop yes. projecting. They were for me. They were brothers and sisters for me, I think.
For sure. You know, and also just fundamental escapism.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't want to be one of those parents who's the kids these days and their technology and blah, blah, blah. But I think like boredom was a big part of my childhood. Mm-hmm. And just sort of this idea of like when you don't have a sibling, it's like entertain yourself. Mm-hmm. And there were books, and I always liked reading, and I felt like I liked telling stories from a very early age. So that was just something that it was my jam. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did spend a lot of time with books and reading and rereading them. And I think that, you know, The Stand, at least in my memory, was like one of the first grown-up books that I read, mm-hmm. that it sort of felt like, ooh, like, this is scary and provocative, and it had the supernatural around it. Mm-hmm. I think it's the second Stephen King book that I read. The first one was Firestarter, mm-hmm. which is sort of a much simpler book. The Stand is like, you know, it was very intimidating in terms of how large it is. And it was first released, which is the one that I read. It was probably like 800 plus pages.
Wow.
And then there was an unabridged edition that was released, you know, almost a decade later, that had like 400 pages that he had originally written. And his editor was like, Jesus, you know, it's too long. Like, this thing is a murder weapon now. But because it became a bestseller and international phenomenon, they were like, oh, maybe these other 400 pages are great. And they were. Like, I mean, it's sort of that idea of like going back and revisiting something, and there's new material, mm-hmm. and fleshing out of characters and all that stuff.
When did you have you reread it? When was the last time you reread it, is what I'm trying to ask.
Great question. I'm 44 now, so probably like a decade ago, uh-huh. at some point in my mid-30s, uh-huh. I reread it. And Stephen King wrote this great book called On Writing, which is one of my favorite things that he's ever written. That
it's
is, you know, it's autobiographical about his own childhood and the kind of kid that he was. And then takes us through his career and his relationship with his wife Tabitha, who basically like he thought that he was useless and a hack, and Carrie, which was his, you know, which is his first book that became a massive success, he basically like threw it in the garbage, and she literally fished it out and read it and said, this isn't bad. So it's like it's got all these great, you know, pieces of, and he talks about his the struggles with addiction and, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. But it also kind of for someone who had read all of those books that he was referring to, and just sort of watching his star rise. And but The Stand, we can get into the more meta conversation, which will bore the pants off of people, of like, what, you know, why is Stephen King not really considered like a writer of literature, but he's sort of more, I think, like in the kind of pop culture pantheon. Mm. But The Stand felt, even though it's built on sort of a genre premise, it also felt like it was qualitatively like kind of on par with the stuff that I was starting to read in school around that time in like fifth and sixth grade. Like, you know, they give you like Animal Farm and Lord of the mm-hmm, Flies. Mm-hmm. We were sort of like, ooh, this is literature. Mm-hmm. Like, these are real books. Mm-hmm. Like Animal Farm, it's about animals. Lord of the Flies, it's about kids. But mm-hmm. you're sort of like, oh, there's like symbolism and imagery.
I smell an allegory.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, so there was a density and a richness and a complexity of character. Mm. And like, that's what I really got into, was just how dense it felt.
And this may just be hindsight, but was that validating in the moment? Was that like, oh, you can write, you can turn this genre into something of this quality?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess where I'm going is like, what made it formative, other than just knowing it was good literature or deciding it was good literature? What made it formative to you? How did it?
I think there were a couple things. I mean, I think one of them was that it was creating its own mythology, mm-hmm. as opposed to trading on a pre-existing mythology. Sure. You know, like Greco-Roman mythology, or even something like Harry Potter, mm-hmm. which, you know, easily could have made my list because sure. I am obsessed with those books. But it's yeah. like, you know, J.K. Rowling just created the magic exists in all sorts of different pieces of literature, but she created this dense mythology, mm-hmm. and designed rules of magic and came up with institutions for magic, mm-hmm. and like school
and ministries
and, you know, like, and so yeah. like all these things. And the stands sort of saying like, okay, we understand that there's this thing called God and this thing called the devil, but in the stand, we're going to call God Mother Abigail, and uh-huh. we're going to call the devil Randall Flagg. And uh-huh. so it's a classic tale of good and evil. But I think that the other thing that really stood out about it, and it was obviously a major influence for all the storytelling that I wanted to do, was that traditionally speaking, you know, my understanding of narrative was there is a hero, uh-huh. you know, and this person, this hero, is at the hub of all the other characters, uh-huh. but we are on this hero's journey. So even Star Wars, which, you know, was the movie that first imprinted upon me, you're like, yeah, Han Solo is great, and I like Princess Leia, and Darth Vader's like a great bad guy, but it's Luke Skywalker's story, uh-huh. whereas The Stand had a dozen heroes, some of which became good guys and some of which became bad guys, and then some of them die along the way, mm-hmm. Which I felt was like sort of like, oh my God, radical. Wow, like you killed sure. this guy off. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of felt like this felt more like life to me. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the hero of my own story, but in Sonya's story, I'm just a supporting character, uh-huh. Or I'm just like, I'm an adjunct to whatever sure. her hero's journey is. Sure. And so starting to see the way that everybody interlocked. And then he did that, King did that thing that George R. R. Martin does in the, Song of Ice and Fire books, which is each chapter is really just told through the exclusive point of view of one individual. Hmm. And so in The Stand, there's a guy named Stu Redmond, who I think, if memory serves, he kind of starts out more or less in like Vermont. He's mm-hmm. like in Stovington, Vermont. And then you jump to this guy, Larry Underwood, and he's in New York City. And this woman, Franny, and this guy, Harold, they're up in Maine. Mm-hmm. And it just, you're just hearing it all from their point of view. Mm-hmm. And as they're gradually kind of making their way towards one another. And I kind of felt like that idea of like, oh, this is cool. Like yeah. it's the team coming together, etc. But exploring multiple points of view, not really understanding who the hero was, mm-hmm. Presenting a world that was, you know, kind of spinning on that axis of there's a purpose behind all this. Mm-hmm. This is all happening for a reason, but you don't exactly know what the rules are. And then the mixing of the supernatural and the natural, where
you've just described every show you've ever written.
That's exactly right. And all the shows that I love. But I love dense, sprawling mythologies.
Yeah. Interesting. So interesting that this might be a genesis for that, or that you see it as that.
You know, this
and it points to one book.
This and Watchmen, sure. you know, were the two kind of seminal pieces of writing that made me kind of lock in on and say like, oh, that's the music that I want to
right.
play.
We'll get to Watchmen in 1 second. I have one more question, which is, were you storytelling already at this age? Were you writing creatively? Did you journal? Were you?
Yeah, I mean, if you believe my mom, and I do,
I will.
You know, I was telling stories, you know, when I was, you know, 3 or 4 uh-huh. years old, and then she would transcribe them.
Really?
And I think that the stories...
Does she still have them somewhere? That's awesome, Damon. That's so great.
I suspect she does. Uh-huh. But I think that my stories were mainly kind of derived from the things that I was, you know, see, they were sure. more like retellings of things that I was watching versus like, I have this incredibly original idea. And I saw Star Wars when I was 4 in 1977. So almost all my stories were basically just right. bad Star Wars ripoffs.
Right.
But I was striving for some level of originality, whether or not I captured it.
I think you did. But I'm also like, I feel like, I mean, everyone points to this example, but we wouldn't have Shakespeare if he hadn't been retelling stories we all knew. So I think there's a complete legitimacy to taking tropes and turning them into your own thing.
For sure.
I watched my daughter Billy do a puppet show on Thanksgiving that she endearingly pulled out every stuffed toy she had and decided to entertain all 22 of our guests with a puppet show. And it was that moment of feeling both completely overwhelmed with pride at my daughter and also like, just
I have some notes.
You just have
yes.
to.
Right, yes, exactly.
A couple of thoughts and also just tone it down. Just
right,
half,
yes,
baby.
Exactly.
Just half.
What's
Rain
the bunny's motivation? I lost him a little bit there.
A little bit. Yeah. But also like, now let's just calm it down and put it all away because I can't be that parent. I can't be the parent who's like dotingly watching on, waking up. Well, you know, 22 guests have fallen asleep behind me with their sort of my indulgence of my daughter. But I relate because I watched her do her puppet show and I felt the regurgitation of myth and story and the stories that we tell her and the stories we're reading to her. And it's just, you know, interesting. You're the first interview I've done for season two. Really, like, having listened to season one and sort of thought about it, like the consolidation of what we are, who we are in childhood and what these stories that we hear and how they, how it just goes without saying, but how formative they are. Like,
sure.
They just become the stories that we then retell and retell, and the ones that echo and chime, as you say, these sprawling big stories with multiple heroes, becomes that becomes your motif, is both sort of inevitable and yet still somehow extraordinary that you can trace it back to.
Yeah, and I think in many ways I agree with everything that you just said, and it is also a religious experience, and by that I mean, if you sort of look to existing on the planet prior to the 19th of the 20th century, particularly in Western culture, the only stories that you have are religious stories, primarily. Just, you know, okay, there's the, you know, there's the Bible, whether it's the Old Testament, the New Testament, or it's a combination of the two. And then, you know, once the printing press comes along, and that's obviously well before the 18th century, but you're starting to see now fiction, and like now these new myths are basically being built. But I think that by time I was born in the 1970s in America, you know, with primarily my father was a devout atheist and my mom was Jewish, but like, you know, culturally Jewish as opposed to like, you're supposed to believe this chapter and verse. So I had exposure to those stories, but like my Bible, like my myth basically came from, you know, a variety of different influences and fiction writers and movies and television shows and all that stuff. But they were all basically channeling those same fundamental ideas of, you know, morality play, good versus evil. Like, you know, why am I here?
Right.
Like, those deeper sort of more philosophical, that was another thing that I connected to in The Stand, by the way, which is like, you know, it felt like it was philosophical. Mm-hmm. It felt like the characters had real purpose. It wasn't just about getting the girl or killing the bad guy. Mm-hmm. It was sort of about like, I have a role to play in the larger universe, and that there's something suggestive there. You know, there's puppet strings at play, and I don't know who's holding them, but I'm either rejecting my purpose or I'm embracing it.
It's so interesting because I want to talk about The Watchmen, but that immediately makes me want to talk about one of your other books, which is not Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead,
yes.
Ayn Rand.
Yes.
Just because of what you just said about, so we may need to blend them all, but but the role, you know, The Fountainhead, Ayn Rand, was published in 1943. Howard Roark and his rugged individualism and his the ferocity of his belief in the role of the artist and the responsibility of the artist to himself, not his civic responsibility, but his role. And I guess just following up from what you were saying, like this idea that an artist has a story to tell and that nothing must compromise it and that nothing must get in its way. And that as civilization evolves, so artists are the ones that are going to be supporting it. I mean, he's literally an architect. He's building things that are holding civilization up. It's interesting because he seems at odds with these other stories that you've loved, who are these everyman heroes who are all out in a way, in more of a community way. They're all the heroes of their own journeys, but they're doing it in support of something larger. And Howard Roark feels like he's not doing that. Do you feel that with it?
Yeah, and he, you know, he's... I think that the word anti-hero sort of like, it becomes a catch-all for...
Sure.
But it's what the opposite of a hero is. But I think that the idea that Roark was simultaneously very unlikable, but like profoundly charismatic, and like he had a code. Mm. That was the other thing where, and his code was an artist code. And I appreciate architecture, but I'm not an architecture mm-hmm. buff. And I think that the real accomplishment in that particular book, because I've read other, I've read Atlas Shrugged, which is great. But I think that the reason that The Fountainhead really stood out for me was something that I had really relatively no interest in, mm-hmm. appreciation for, but no interest, mm-hmm. like basically came to life. And it's because it was using art as the language and the, mm. and the sort of idea of like how he related to others. And then Keating, like the idea that there is this sort of force of mediocrity out there and that the artist's, greatest foe is mediocrity mm-hmm. and compromise. Mm-hmm. And so that, and you can't really have one without the other. Mm-hmm. The system basically falls apart. And I think that I am definitely still a huge fan of that book just because I think it's marvelously written. And I read it in college. And the reason that I read it was this young woman that I really liked, had mentioned that it was her favorite book, and I was like, "This is my in." And then it's also, and I know that it again, I can only say like this was my experience when I read it as a 19-year-old, mm-hmm. which it was like really sexy to me because mm. Rourke's relationship with like Dominique. Yeah. It wasn't until like later that I was like, "Ooh, this is kind of problematic." Right. Like,
I mean, I'm with you totally.
Is this rape? Like, what's going on? What's her story? Yeah. You know, she felt like she had the same rugged individualism, and then she's kind of a cynic. She's sort of more like, I believe that Rourke is right, but I know that the world is not going to allow the Rourkes of the, to sort of thrive.
To succeed, yeah.
You know, so all that dynamism. And then, as is the case in most of Rand's books, you kind of get to the final 100 or 200 pages, and it's just this massive monologue of dense philosophy that fundamentally abandons what we would traditionally call a story. But I was like, what really is just so striking about The Fountainhead is, and why, here we are, 70 years later, and guys like Paul Ryan, who I have nothing in common in terms of what their political beliefs, but he basically identifies as a Randian, mm. It's like mm-hmm. this idea of the objectivism is something to be celebrated, and you sort of go like, oh, that's really interesting in terms of we both kind of have a level of respect for this philosophy, mm-hmm. but we don't agree about like what space there is for that philosophy, because I think Rand was very specific in saying that socialism sucked.
Right.
And that isn't me saying I'm a socialist, but I am a bleeding heart liberal. And right. So this sort of fundamental idea of like, there can be no exceptionalism unless there's mediocrity. Mm-hmm. And I had the pleasure of working on a movie with Brad Bird, who made one of my favorite Pixar films, The Incredibles, mm. which is basically built on this philosophy of like, no one is super unless there's people who are less than super.
Right.
And we shouldn't be giving trophies out for participation mm-hmm. because that basically lessens the value yeah. of the trophies that we give to people for excellence.
Right.
And we are a very trophy obsessed culture. Mm-hmm. And it's crazy that like the National Book Awards exist, or Pulitzer Prizes. And you're just basically like, so these books are competing against one another, or these, we're giving Emmys or Grammys mm-hmm. out. Like, we're basically putting art, on the field of play and yeah. seeing and making some determination about what is best.
Right.
But I always think about Rand when those sort of situations arise, and Rourke is just kind of I really respond to characters who are Rourke-ish. Don Draper is one of those.
Yeah.
Is one of those guys. He's so good at being an ad man.
Yeah.
But he's such a fucking mess.
Yeah.
And that's the other part of it, which is, to be an artist is to be emotionally dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of my primary takeaways from The Fountainhead, and a little bit scary too, because it's sort of like, if I'm an artist, does this mean that I'm gonna, that I'm gonna be dysfunctional? And
yeah,
what does that mean?
Totally. No, we have this, I used to have this conversation a lot with friends, was like, how fucked up do I have to be good?
Yeah.
And am I not fucked up enough? Should I have got more fucked up?
Right.
In order to have more to access, to have more, of an emotional pull.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
To draw on. I'm with you with Howard Roark. I did not love the book when I read it, and I read it a long time ago. I read it in my 20s as well, and I haven't read it since. It'd be interesting to revisit, actually. I found him too strident, too opinionated. I didn't relate. I felt for Dominique, and I felt weird compassion for the, like, mediocre Peter Keating. I felt like, what's fucking wrong with that? I mean, I hear you, Howard. I get it. We'd all love to be like you, but a girl's got to eat and a living must be made.
Yes.
And you can't eat your high morals. You know, you can't pay your rent with that.
Right.
I'm wondering now whether, at the ripe old age of 43, whether I revisit that and I go, no, I hear you. There's room for both. There's room for both, which is, I think, where you're
going. I'm more interested to ask you, when you say you didn't like it, like, I kind of feel like, was it upsetting to you? Did you have an emotional reaction to it? Where it's sort of like, that's where I get confused sometimes in terms of my response to literature or music, or there's something that I can't tell the difference between something that upsets me and something that I don't like.
Yeah.
And then, you know, can I evaluate this, you know, this piece of art as something that is good or bad, or I like or I don't like, versus how does it make me feel?
Right.
And I can just say, like, I've never reread The Fountainhead, ever. It's the only time that I've ever read it. And so, like, for me to base it, I couldn't even, like, kind of walk you through the plot points. I just am sort of like, oh, I remember why I read it. I remember really liking it. I remember this brief and sort of, like, tempestuous relationship.
Did you get the girl after reading the book?
We were already we were already in the flirtation, but it was like, I really want her to like me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was a college relationship, the half-life of which is fleeting, but I really liked the book, and I was going to pretend to like it whether I did or not. I found it very compelling.
That sounds about right for a college relationship.
Yeah.
Let's go back to The Watchman, which, tell me when you read that. Was that contemporary with the Stephen King? Was it later?
Well, I read it when I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's a comic book, so it was released as single. There are 12 issues, and it was released as single issues originally on a monthly schedule, but Alan Moore, who is the writer, and Dave Gibbons, who is the artist, and so they're co-credit, you know, it's by those guys. But Alan Moore is largely to blame, by his own admission, for falling behind on schedule.
Uh-huh.
So by the time you got into, you know, the final issues of the book, 9, 10, 11, 12, there were maybe like 2 or 3 months between each issue coming out. And so I read it in a serialized fashion, in much the same way that we watch television now.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was in the mid-1980s, 85, 86, there was no internet, obviously. And so the idea that inside the, you know, the kind of comic book fan community, it was all word of mouth that this was the new sound.
Wow.
And I think that the idea of, like, Watchmen transcended, this is really good, or this is a really good comic book, and entered into that, I've never seen this before.
Yeah.
Also, I'll never forget it. When my dad handed me, so he had read the first two issues, and he handed me the first two issues, and he said, "You're not ready for this."
Great words from a parent.
In the second issue of Watchmen, there is a very graphic rape scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may have been my first sort of like, what's rape?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what's happening here?
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like, I understood what sex was.
Mm-hmm.
I understood where babies came from. But this idea that a man could forcibly rape a woman was sort of like introduced to me.
Right.
you know, in a comic book.
Yeah.
And also our feelings about comic books are that they're safe, you mm-hmm. know, like Batman's going to get the bad guy.
Right.
Superman is going to win. And Watchmen very clearly basically said, we're going to present stark, real psychological examinations of people who put on masks and ask, like, who are they and why do they do this?
Mm-hmm.
And with the exception of one individual, Dr. Manhattan, none of them really have powers
right.
To speak of. They're just vigilantes. And it's also, it's a historical story in that it's set in an alternate version of 1985.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1985, where there are superheroes or mm-hmm. costumed adventurers, as they're called in this world, where we've won the Vietnam War and Richard Nixon is still the president of the United States, and fashion and technology and music and cuisine all look slightly different than they did to me
mm-hmm.
sitting there in the mid-80s. So this, it flashes back all the way to the 1930s
mm-hmm.
In its storytelling. And so this idea of, like, it just felt so rich and so thought out, and in every single panel. And again, Alan Moore deserves all the credit. It's a masterwork, maybe his greatest piece of writing ever. But Dave Gibbons, who was the artist, you know, there was an emotional depth to the characters
mm-hmm.
that I had never seen before. And I started really having feeling things,
uh-huh.
you know, level of real empathy and sadness, and all the characters in Watchmen are sad. And that to me was really interesting, because the idea that superheroes even could be sad.
Sure,
you know,
radical, yeah.
They could be angry, they could seek vengeance, but the idea of, like, oh, you skipped the part in the Batman story where he was sad.
Right.
You know, or this idea that Batman is basically avenging the death of his parents because they were gunned down in front of him when he was a little boy. And he's super, like, but when does that stop?
Right.
You know, he's dressing up as a giant bat and we're celebrating that, as
right.
opposed to saying, like, this is a psychosis.
This is insane.
You know, and sort of unpacking all those ideas. And I think then the other thing is, like, there was sort of a sense of humor.
Mm.
I think we would call it trolling now,
mm-hmm.
but Alan Moore loved comics and the history of comics so much. He was also an outsider from the UK, and so he has this dense history of American superheroes through Superman and Batman, but also sort of the irreverence of a Brit,
mm-hmm.
and he sort of cut his teeth writing a lot of mostly science fiction stories in the UK. He did this thing called Future Shock and wrote on Judge Dredd, which was a very popular,
mm-hmm.
and before he was recruited by DC and started writing American comic books. But every time that he would do his spin on Superman or Green Lantern or most famously Swamp Thing, he reinvented
mm-hmm.
It with, like, his own sort of, again, I'd call it trolling, but it was sort of this idea of, like, I'm not afraid to make fun of this thing that I also worship.
Yeah.
You know, and so that created this real interesting frequency of fun without ever, like, desiccating, like, at the altar of comics-dom.
Yeah.
Dumb.
Yeah.
And it also elevated comics into something that was, like, really respected as literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all happening live for me. And then, most importantly, it was a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas The Stand certainly had mysterious elements in terms of, like, who is Randall Flagg and why is he, like, the premise of Watchmen is that there is a murder committed in the first issue. This character called the Comedian is murdered, and so it's asking the question, who killed the Comedian and why?
Mm.
And by the time you get to the 12th issue, the identity of the murderer is revealed, but the why is so vast and so complex that it takes these 12 issues to build it. And at the thing that I really remember firing my neurons was at the end of every issue, there'd be these kind of ancillary materials. So in the first couple issues of Watchmen, there were excerpts from an autobiography written by one of the characters in it.
Oh,
called,
wow.
Who's largely off panel, this guy Hollis Mason. And then, so you're sort of like, oh, that's what it's going to be. Every issue of Watchmen, I'm going to get another excerpt of Under the Hood. Then it switches gears and you get scientific papers on Dr. Manhattan's origin, or like a Playboy interview with
Amazing.
With Ozymandias. And so, like, or there's the pirate comic called Tales from the Black Freighter that one of the characters is basically reading, and it becomes a comic inside the comic that starts up around the fourth issue. And then one of these ancillary materials is basically talking about the writer of that comic and why pirate comics are popular in the mid-1980s of this world is because superhero comics wouldn't be popular in a world where there are actual superheroes. So just the amount of thinking, the levels of depth, the world building, like, it was just off the charts.
Yeah. That sounds extraordinary. Yeah, it's amazing. Really does. Yeah, that's one to read. I have it on my list, and I see you got one there, and you're adapting it, right? HBO, is that right?
Yeah, we are
doing your version.
I think that we'll see if adapting.
Oh, is that not the word? Sorry.
It may be the right word at the end of the day. So, do you watch Fargo at all?
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like I wouldn't call Noah Hawley's version of Fargo an adaptation.
No, I agree.
Because the movie exists inside of his world, and so everything that happened in the movie Fargo, it does precede the television show Fargo. So, you know, they find a bag of money in the first season of Fargo, and you're like, oh, that came from the movie. Yeah. But it's also, Noah is pulling from other areas of the Coen brothers canon, and so it evokes, like, Lebowski. And,
totally.
And it's also his own thing. So, I don't know. I think that it's widely known that Alan Moore does not want Watchmen to be adapted.
Uh-huh.
So I'm playing a bit of a game of semantics here and saying, I'm not adapting Watchmen.
I get it. You know? I get it fully. I'm married to Davey Holmes, who created Get Shorty.
So, oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
so that's
cool.
Davey's show. And,
yes.
And
I haven't checked it out yet, but I hear it's great.
Familiar,
it's Romano, right?
With these semantics.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I think it's not an adaptation, nor is it an homage. It's simply a take of a great source material and then expanding it and leaning into it and rolling it around and turning it into your own version. So
yeah, and that's the spirit of what he did in Watchmen in the first place. And it's not to take, you know, he created this, that it's an original world, but the basis for that world is on these other characters that DC had just bought from this other comics books company called Charlton, and he did riffs on those characters. But all his other work, you know, that I love, whether it be Swamp Thing, or he wrote an amazing Superman story called Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, and a great Batman story, but it's sort of like the idea that he came in and told iconic stories with characters that he didn't create and has now turned around and said, you're not allowed to do that with the iconic characters that I created. I sort of feel like, you know, his own hypocrisy enables me to,
proceed.
To defile his.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I'm just always reminded of, when I fell in love with my wife and I wanted to propose to her, she's from the South, born in Kentucky, raised in Jacksonville, Florida, but her dad and mom are Kentuckians. And so I was like, do I have to ask their permission? Mm-hmm. Like, how's this work? And she was like, don't ask my parents' permission to marry me. Like, you know, like, that's, you ask me.
Sure.
Like, it would be nice if you, like, asked for their blessing.
Right.
And I'm like, what if they don't give it to me? And then she's like, fuck them. So I feel like I have to I ask Alan Moore for his blessing, but I have to be prepared for him to tell me to go fuck myself.
And then do it anyway. Yeah.
I'd be kind of disappointed if he didn't tell me to go fuck myself.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's, if Alan Moore was suddenly like, huh, like, let's see what you do with it. I'd be like, this is not the Alan Moore that I know and love. I want you to hate the very idea that this exists.
That's so
there's something
funny.
A little bit punk about doing it.
Yeah.
It feels riskier that the progenitor of this material, one of them, Dave Gibbons is the other one again, is basically saying, you do this without my permission.
Right, at your own peril.
Yeah.
I'm going to move us on to the next one because I want us not to run out of time. Your other book, one of the other books, was Great Expectations, which was just so fun to see. And I'm struck, too, that that is another serialized read, although it was not serialized when you read it.
But, right, yes.
But that you gravitated towards another book that strung out a story and that ended every chapter with a cliffhanger. You know, cliffhanger.
Sure,
and
sure.
That, has multiple heroes. I mean, Pip's the hero, but we've got a lot of people to root for in that book.
Right.
And, how old were you when you read it?
I think I was like maybe a freshman in high school. Uh-huh. So I was in ninth grade, so 14 or 15.
Was it your first Dickens?
In there. It was my first Dickens. Yes, absolutely. And my favorite Dickens, uh-huh. which is why it makes the list. And then I'm only realizing this now as you're sitting across from me, but this was, Desmond had his copy of Our Mutual Friend, and Carlton is also a huge Dickens fan.
Oh, I think really?
That's like when he and I first met, and he hired me. He was running the show called Nash Bridges and gave me really one of my first jobs in the business. But he very quickly outed himself as a Dickens fan, and he told this story about John Irving, who almost made my list, but I'm also a huge John Irving fan. Hotel New Hampshire and Prayer for Owen Meany and Garp, of course.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if this has changed, but or if it's an urban legend. But Irving basically is a huge Dickens file, like yeah. obsessive Dickens. And the one Dickens book that he has not read is Our Mutual Friend. And the thinking is that basically he's like, when I realize that that death is imminent, then I'm going to read it. But I'm sort of like I'm keeping it.
That's
it's like
great.
I hope you don't die in a car crash.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
I hope
yeah.
that you get some sort of a warning.
Yeah,
but
sweet. It's one of the few I haven't read either. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, I think, you know, for Dickens, it's the multiple characters, it's the and also coincidence. Like that to me, I think, is something that I love. I love hearing about coincidences in real life, and I love coincidences in narrative fiction. But I think that it's also a dirty word in narrative fiction.
Sure.
The idea of coincidence. It's a note that I get often mm-hmm. and legitimately so, because it's sort of like, okay,
well, that's convenient.
This feels contrived,
yeah.
you know, and you can't just have John Locke say, I think everything's happening for a reason, but it's still a coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, when is a greater cosmic power at play, and
sure.
when is, and Dickens seemed to just, like, you know, be able to pull that off every mm-hmm. time, where it was sort of like his plots are built, and especially in terms of the way that they all come together at the end, they're built around a tremendous amount of sort of coincidence and mm-hmm. happenstance,
mm-hmm.
but it never feels like it's a cheat or contrived. Mm-hmm. There's something kind of like delightful about mm-hmm. it. And I think that, you know, the reason that so much of his writing is, you know, kind of still holds up and is still taught and can be appreciated in the way that it is, or that A Christmas Carol, like, has this kind of like eternal longevity, like mm-hmm. every single year, you know, they're remaking kind of some version mm-hmm. of it, is like sort of built around his tone. And that's mm-hmm. another thing that I think that is really important to me in terms of the books that I read, is that there is just like and it's indescribable, right? Where you say, like, all of Rand's books have a very specific tone to them.
Mm-hmm.
There's something a little bit cold and impersonal
mm-hmm.
and the characters are experiencing emotions, but the way that the emotions are conveyed to the reader are very clinical.
Yeah.
You know, and King has his own way of sort of doing that, and maybe to the diminishment of his artistic merits, but it's sort of like considered like a little bit more pulpy,
mm-hmm.
his tone, but I think it's like really rich and
mm-hmm.
And delicious. And I think that we have to be able to be a culture where it's sort of like, if we're eating, you know, filet mignon all the time, what's the matter with a good cheeseburger?
Sure.
And you can't say that a great chef can't make a good cheeseburger, or that
sure.
a cheeseburger isn't a valid form of food.
Yeah.
But with Dickens, there's just something like, I'm no literary scholar, but if you were to basically present to me, here is a manuscript that I believe was written by Dickens, read 20 pages of it and tell me
mm-hmm.
whether or not it's the real deal, I feel like I could.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was basically manufactured by someone great. And I also love the whole mystery of Edwin Drood thing,
mm-hmm.
where he died before he finished it.
Before he finished
And so this idea of like, oh, okay, what if? You know, what is the answer? We'll never
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Dickens to me is so interesting, because he's shown up on a few people's lists, and there is something so heartfelt about him, and he can get accused of, you know, sentimentality or of being cloying or whatever, but the man was a stylist like nobody else. I don't know anybody who could write the insides of people and the outsides of people so beautifully, and could hone in on you know, a distinguishing characteristic, and then that was who Uriah Heep was. He was just the endlessly hand-wringing guy.
Right.
Or in David Copperfield, or you know, Joe the blacksmith was just the good man. And they all have these sort of epithets that they carry throughout, and yet somehow they don't feel reductive. Somehow you always know who you're talking about. They're still multidimensional, even though they've been reduced sort of to their signature epithet every time. I find Dickens more and more complex as I get older. I think as a younger reader, I loved him too. But I thought there was something deceptively simplistic, not simple, but simplistic about the way he was writing. And as I go older and I revisit, and I was rereading Bleak House the other day, and I was just like, holy shit, this is just breathtaking fiction. It really is.
Yeah, he's off the charts. And when I read Great Expectations, obviously not as a chapbook, a serialized, but in its completed version, at the back of the book was the original ending, you know, which is sort of, my understanding is, and again, I'm probably getting this wrong. I should have looked this up so I could seem like I was more educated on it.
No, but don't worry. This isn't a podcast about education.
It was basically, it was serialized, and then the ending was even more sad than the ending that we are largely familiar with for those of us who have read the book, in terms of Pip and Estella's, you know, sort of final exchange. Mm. But readers just hated it. Oh. And so he rewrote the ending.
Oh, really?
And so what has basically survived through history is the rewrite versus the original that was read by people who were, and I just think, like, all the time, like, what if we just basically did, like, another finale of Lost?
Oh my God.
And we're, like, basically, like, just forget that other one. And by the way, like, I stand by, make no apologies for, love the ending that
no
we did.
No, should you, no, should you. Know, you
but at the same time, it's sort of like, when I found that out about Dickens, I was sort of bummed out, because I wanted him to be like, fuck you, this is the ending that you get. I'm Charles Dickens, yo. Which would have been anachronistic and probably culturally inappropriate for someone living in his time.
Now I want Lin-Manuel Miranda to write
exactly.
The story of Dickens.
That's right.
That would be fucking awesome. Let's get to your last book, Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead.
Have you read it?
I have not. It's on my nightstand.
You have to read it.
Yeah, I've been told by everybody I have to read this book.
This book I did read and didn't listen to. It's probably the last piece of fiction that I read. I read it
last year,
read it over the summer.
And why formative? I'm always interested when there's a modern book that shows up that's formative.
It's the first time that I've read a book, maybe ever, or certainly in my memory, where I wept while reading.
Really?
And I'm an easy cry, like in a movie or for like TV shows. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, by easy cry, I mean like it has to be done well.
Of course.
But it's like,
but
if
you,
I just think about like
that.
The beginning of Up, I start to get choked.
Yeah, me
like
too.
my let's not talk about it.
No.
But I will spoil nothing. I will just say you've got to read Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. But the penultimate chapter of the book, not the very end, but like the emotional culmination of the book, like hit me like a ton of bricks.
Mm-hmm.
I completely didn't expect it.
Oh.
Because it's a book about the experience of slavery told from the point of view of an escaped slave named Cora. And it's not exclusively in her a point of view. We're also occasionally in the point of view of the guy who is hunting her, Ridgway. And a couple of other secondary characters, we lapse into their point of view, but she is the hero.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just about her journey. And so obviously, like any slave narrative, it's heartbreaking and painful and emotionally distressing. There is another element of the book where, again, if you do not know anything about Underground Railroad, and I did not know this when I read it, was this, again, took my breath away in terms of what once it declares what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So all I knew about it is what I'm telling you now.
Uh-huh.
Is that it was an escaped slave narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm spoiling anything to say, like, there is a genre element.
Uh-huh.
But that almost doesn't do justice to what it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And then this kind of emotional wallop. And so I think that was what was essentially formative is the frequency of the emotional wallop. Why I wept is different than why I traditionally, you know, where if I go like, okay, so here's what happens at the beginning of Up, and it's about these people falling in love, starting with them as kids and falling in love, and then she can't have a baby, and then they're looking at the clouds and they have this book, and then she dies, and like, and then you're like, okay, I understand why that's sad.
Right.
For me to unpack for you why I wept is so inexplicable. You can only experience it through the journey of the book.
Mm-hmm.
When I've come across other people who have read Underground Railroad, and I just say like, oh, that penultimate chapter, and like, and they just nod, yeah. And I kind of, it's like the wake nod, you know, where you're basically like, I'm remembering this person.
This
like,
is.
It's
yeah.
unbelievable.
Oh,
it's jaw dropping.
Oh, I
it's
can't
so,
wait.
It's so good. It's so good.
You mentioned, I'm going to give you my little follow-up questions now, but this is one of them. You mentioned that this was the last work of fiction that you'd read. Do you traditionally read nonfiction?
I traditionally read fiction, but like, I do like nonfiction, and I'm not a huge biography guy, mm-hmm. but I like sort of like specific incidents of like a book about like Waco or the Tulsa race massacre or unpacking Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
Like those kind of things are interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the wake of what happened in the 2016 election, probably more of a lean into Hillbilly Elegy and Strangers in Their Own Land. And I'm trying to kind of understand the world that I was... The America that I thought I was living
in
is actually not the America that I've been living in. And
I agree.
So, like, as opposed to being angry about that and saying, stomping my feet and saying, but I want it to be this way, there's like some sort of
need
effort
to
kind of understand it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I definitely leaned harder. And then my wife, I think, prefers nonfiction. She read Americana, which you and I were talking about earlier, and she's reading Lindy West's new book, which she just reads and laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And then she nods and she like talks to her books, which I love.
That's
and
adorable.
I'm like, she's like, you've got to read this.
Is she who you get your recommendations from?
Yeah, I mean, there are some books that we read together,
mm-hmm.
And then...
At the same time?
Yeah, sort of like overlapping.
Sort of, yeah, right.
And then there's books that she will explain to me in such great detail or vice versa that is like, oh, I don't even
I'm
need
done.
To read that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's funny. Do you... is there a book that you expected to like but didn't?
Huh. That's a good question.
You can come back to it.
Yeah, let's come back,
we'll
to,
come
it.
Back
I can't,
to it.
I can't remember.
Do you read poetry?
I don't read poetry.
Have you ever?
No. I mean, I read poetry when I was in high school and college because it was mandated.
Mandatory. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but, and I enjoy a good poem. And I like in The New Yorker, like,
yeah.
you know, those just sort of like little stanzas. I go like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
But I
appreciate them too. They give me my dose. They make me feel like I hit that.
I appreciate the artistry, but it's sort of like, it's not, it's not my jam.
Yeah, yeah.
I wish that I liked poetry more.
Do you, what's the best adaptation of a book that you know of?
I think Kubrick's The Shining is probably one, you know, getting back to Stephen King is like an extraordinary adaptation. And what's interesting about it is that King hates it.
Oh,
you know?
Does he? That's fascinating.
For valid reasons from King's perspective. But I think that, you know, The Shining is the scariest movie that I've ever seen. Mm. And I'm a big Kubrick fan. So I think that's a pretty extraordinary.
That's a great answer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You get to take one book to your desert island. What is it?
Oh, wow. Just one.
One.
Desert island.
Mm.
Hmm. Hopefully a book that I can drink. I don't know. I guess I probably would bring Lord of the Flies because that would be...
That'd be a handbook.
Least, yeah. Like, hey, I'm on a desert island. Might as well. I haven't read that one since high school either. And or I probably need to bring a slightly larger book, like maybe War and Peace. I've never read it.
Oh, there you go.
But it's always like the, you know, that goes hand in hand with this is an incredibly long book. It's like, it's War and Peace. And let's just be honest. I'm going to need a lot of toilet paper.
You're going to...
So, you know, I don't know what those leaves are going to give me a rash. So
there you go. You got it all. War and Peace will not disappoint, that I can promise you. Damon, thank you so much. This was
my
such
pleasure.
A pleasure.
Thank you for having
thank
me
you.
And for talking books. Go read, everybody.
Go read, everybody.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's interview. If you like the show, please write us a review on iTunes, on the website. It really makes a difference. Rate us, give us some stars, let your friends know, let your family know, tell everyone you can. Go to the website, bookishwithsonyawalger.com, if you want to find out about any of the books that you heard about. We list there not only the five favorites, but every single book that is referenced. You can also buy the books through the website, and we make a tiny, tiny little percentage of whatever you buy through the website. So if you are interested, please go ahead and click on that. You can find us on Facebook. We have a Bookish with Sonia Walger page. You can find us on Twitter with @BookishSonia or @SoniaWalger.com. And you could also email me through the info@BookishWithSoniaWalger.com page. If you hit on contact, it'll just automatically pop up as an email there. So if you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear from or thoughts that you have about the show, please don't hesitate to share them there. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the show.